Chapter 45. The Great Transportation. Surprisingly enough, as the hour of our departure drew closer, I began to get resistance to our plan from the most unlikely of quarters, King Rard. His Majesty was in the process of deploying an army of 30,000 upriver, but was running into serious logistical issues. The swarm of refugees arriving from Alshar and Gilmora had taxed the resources of the regional lords to the point where they were reluctant to let barges pass their shores at all. While the king and his advisers tackled that problem, they wanted me to stay put in Sevendor. Does His Majesty realize he is risking the loss of Castle Cambrian and Barrowbell every hour he delays?
He does,
Master Hartarian told me on the morning of our departure, mind to mind.
He finds it an acceptable risk.
Duin's hair is sack. I don't. And I know the people of Barrowbell sure as hell don't.
That has also been brought to His Majesty's attention, Hartarian said wearily, by no less than Count Fiorine, in whose domain Barrowbell lies. Duke Rard seems steadfast in wanting to be the one to relieve the city. He plans on leading the troops personally. He might take a premature relief force amiss.
He can take it any way he wants it, I warned. I've been working my people night and day for a week so I can make this happen. I have almost 5,000 troops gathered now. That's not enough to stop the Gilmoran invasion, but it might be enough to lift the siege. Then the troops in the castle can help stop the invasion.
I will pass along to His Majesty what you have said,
agreed the former censor general, who was clearly not as used to taking orders as he was giving them. Why in the name of all that is holy is Rard dragging his feet on this? I exploded to Penny as my servants were dressing me in my new armor. Culled from the pile of loot kindly donated by Sire Gimbal's men, I'd found the right pieces to fit my body. Ordinarily, war magi avoid metal armor as it can interfere with some kinds of spells, not to mention being loud, heavy, and hot. But I wasn't merely leading a magical corps this time. I was commanding everyone.
Because Rard wants to be the one who saves the kingdom, Penny explained.
She was getting into her own armor. Her panoply was a compromise between material protection and arcane utility. It began as the heavily waxed, sleeveless leather armor of an archer, strengthened by steel in vulnerable places and heavily enchanted. It would fend off most basic offensive spells and provide her protection. It would be exceedingly difficult for an archer to aim accurately at her, for instance. She'd even accepted a very ladylike mage blade from Master Comoran. Not that she'd likely use it. Penny's command of offensive magics is limited, but included some powerful nastiness. Penny didn't relish the idea of going into battle again, because that's just not where she saw herself when she went to thaumaturgy school, but she was coming along because I was, and she didn't want me to mess things up.
If the spellmonger is the hero again, His Majesty fades in importance, she explained. He just got crowned. He needs to show he's leading the kingdom.
I don't care who gets the credit, let's just save the day,
I insisted as my gorget was strapped around my neck.
I'm sure that's how Rard feels, too.
She decided. She tucked her hair up under her helmet, a small iron cap with leather cheek and neck guards,
because this has all the hallmarks of being family work, not his own device.
I can see that. That doesn't change matters. I didn't take this job to aggrandize Rard's family. I did it to save his subjects. If he doesn't like the way I do it, he can fire me.
Actually, he can't,
Penny assured me.
Even if you lose your seat at court, he cannot take direct action against you for anything less than high treason. I was very careful to write that into our charters.
She looked very pleased with herself.
Well, that's comforting,
I grumbled.
You can't quit, either,
she pointed out helpfully.
I wrote that into the charters, too.
Great,
I said, sighing deeply.
Then I guess I'd better die gloriously in battle.
I summoned my new battle staff to me from across the room. It smacked against my palm with a satisfying snap. Unlike my armor, I had made time to devote to enchanting it. Unlike the civilian staff I had used as a spellmonger, which had several general enchantments on it and only one or two offensive spells, this battle staff had been built especially for me by Master Comoran in a blatant attempt to kiss my butt and bribe me.
It worked like a charm, too. The gorgeous staff was my height, capped at the foot with iron splints down its length, and an elaborate iron head that came complete with knife-blade-like spikes that should prove an excellent deterrent to anyone's head it might come in contact with. The head and shaft were spellbound together so that it was as sturdy as a glaive. Better yet, it had some astounding enchantments upon it, from spells that could kill a single Gervan to enchantments that could affect entire legions. The entire thing was balanced perfectly, too. He'd also seen fit to tune twilight like a harp before a royal performance. The powerful blade was seething with arcane energies in its scabbard on my back. I had no less than 7 war wands on my person. I was more ready for war than I had been ever. I didn't find that as much comfort as I had imagined. So what if I do save the day and earn Rad's wrath?
Then you glory in the exaltation of the grateful population, she said dryly. And then you dodge his reprisals at court until he gets distracted by something shiny. That's how that sort of thing usually works. He needs us more than we need him right now, and he knows it.
Well, he will just have to be satisfied with cleaning up then, because I can't afford to wait.
Wait, bide, I said, as I felt the beginnings of mind-to-mind contact. Master, came the mental voice of Sire Rustallo.
The kid was only a year or so older than Tyndall, but he was a good war mage who had been in the right place at the right time at the Battle of Timberwatch and gotten a small Wilderlands estate as his reward.
We just heard from the Penumbra Rangers.
The who? I asked. I hadn't heard of them.
The Penumbra Rangers are a unit organized to scout and patrol the edge of the Penumbra,
the young High Mage said. They watch the movements of the troops issuing from the Black Veil.
The what?
I demanded.
Sorry, that's what they're calling Beauval now, since no one makes cheese there anymore.
It's romantic and scary, I agreed. It fits perfectly.
Anyway,
Rustallo continued with exaggerated patience, the Rangers reported that they saw at least 1 and possibly 2 dragons take flight from the Black Veil,
flying south.
Are they headed to Barrowbell?
That was my impression, Mage Lord,
he told me reluctantly. I thanked him and passed the information along to Penny.
That's unfortunate, she said thoughtfully.
No, that's calamitous, I corrected. Unfortunate is when you spill your wine on your new tunic. When living fiery death drops out of the sky, that goes beyond unfortunate and firmly into calamitous. She rolled her eyes.
Regardless, a dragon on the way means we need to speed things up. I will summon the Alcaalon. If you wish to go, address and prepare your men.
That morning dawned cool, with the first real breath of autumn on the breeze. Summer's heat was waning quickly in the vales. Winter was on the horizon. I took note of that as I entered my bedchamber, perhaps for the last time. My armor and harness were at odds with the soft white walls, the muslin sheets that beckoned my sleep-deprived body, and the general feeling of domesticity. This was a place for family and love and warmth, not cold steel and hot blood. Alia was waiting for me in her rocker, feeding Menalion. Her face was puffy and her eyes were streaked red, but she wasn't crying anymore. I didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing.
I have to go again,
I said simply.
I know,
she replied softly. I don't want to, I admitted, not one little bit. What I want to do is crawl into that bed, pull you down on top of me, and stay buried until next spring. What I want is to be here with you, and rule this lovely little land, and see it and our children blossom into prosperity. What I want is to never pick up a sword or a wand in anger again. But that's not what the gods have chosen for me.
I know, she said hoarsely. I don't want you to leave either, but I know you have to.
My heart leaped into my throat at the forlorn tone in her voice. She was putting on a brave front, but she was worried, far more worried than she had been under siege and with the warbird at the gates.
I'm sorry,
I whispered.
Don't be, she said sharply. Do you not understand how lucky I feel? Minilin, if it hadn't been for you, this whole vale would be a desert still. None of my people would be alive, and neither would I. You could have walked away after Beauval and remained a hero in our eyes until the end of time.
You could have left me with a baby in my belly and never seen me again, leaving us to our fate. But you didn't. You married me when you didn't have to. You brought my people out of exile and penury and gave them a homeland and a purpose. You showered them with gifts and bolstered them. You were more a lord to them than Kusi ever was. But I've made so many mistakes.
Not really,
she sighed. And this would not be the time for recriminations, even if you had.
No, my husband, my darling, my sweet, sweet lord.
You must realize that is why I love you so dearly. Even as you act as champion and defender of my people, our people, you question your ability to do so. At any point you could have laid us aside and gone on to your fortune. But you didn't. You think I didn't see that flock of biddies making eyes at you at the Chepstow Fair? You could have arranged to wed a high-born lady, or a wealthy one, and no one would have looked askance. But you chose me. And if the price of that happy choice is that I have to risk losing you every now and then, it's not too high.
But Alia, I said exasperated, I'm trying to tell you that I was about to tell her everything about Lady Isili, my illegitimate child she'd just given birth to, her betrayal and the machinations of the family. But she stopped me.
I don't care,
she dismissed simply.
Whatever it is, save your confessions for a priest. I'm your wife. You have built a beautiful life for me and your son and all the Bovali. Whatever else you do as spellmonger, war mage, mage lord, or any other title you happen to collect, the only one that remains important to me is husband. And in that, my dear man, you have performed admirably.
I felt tears well up in my eyes. She had given me a blanket of forgiveness without even hearing my sins. If I had admitted everything about the affair, the woman, the child, she would have calmly nodded her head and accepted it, I knew. But she didn't need to know. She didn't want to know. Whether she suspected what I was to say or not, she had given me all the assurances I needed to ride off to war with my conscience only somewhat soiled. Has a man ever had a better wife than that? I fell to my knees, ignoring how difficult and noisy that is to do in armor, and I laid my head in her lap, just under where she was feeding Minalian. I felt her hand comb through my hair.
Just come back to me alive and in one piece, you big idiot, she whispered.
We all watched expectantly as Sarakim arrived at the departure point, garbed for war. The war mage had exchanged his flamboyant silks for dark leather armor and a close-fitting blackened steel archer's helmet, and he wore two quivers across his back. A short mage blade rode on his hip, and his witchstone glowed in his earring as he took position. He didn't look nervous. That spoke much to his bravery, or much about his intelligence. The Alka Alon had asked that we use a place as proximate to Snowstone as possible, so we cleared a goodly parcel of the Inner Bailey, surrounded as it was by Snowstone, as the best place from which to send ourselves. The Alka had been working steadily through the last few nights, setting up the working. After long consultations and the visit to Sevendor by several Alka I'd never met before, in their short forms, not the prettier humanesque forms, there were now five pillars of Snowstone, hastily harvested from the rubble pile left over from dam construction, arrayed in a circle about 200 yards apart. That should be enough area to transport up to a couple of thousand men, horses, and equipment. In theory. Problem was, the theory was a little thin on the ground. The Alka had not expected, nor had they intended, to give us the secrets to their magical transport. Even as they were preparing the spell, they seemed reluctant and hesitant. Lady Varen explained that the Alka's theory dealt with transporting Alka Alon, not Humani, and yes, there was a difference. She tried to explain it to me several times, and I'm not stupid or ignorant, but I didn't understand it the fourth time any better than the first. In the end, I had to accept her word for it, because I honestly didn't have anything else to go on. While we walked Sarakim to the exact center of the circle, we could see the long line of men, horses, and even some wains lining the roadway all the way back to Sevendor Village. Pentandra and I wished him luck, and Lady Varen did a little more. She produced a shining metal bow of Alkan manufacture, but built to Humani-sized specifications.
A gift, brave one, she said solemnly, It has not escaped our notice that you love the bow almost as much as some of our kindred. To reward you for your bravery, I had this bow created and enchanted after the fashion of our own. May it serve you well, she said, handing it over to the Mawini war mage. Sarakim looked choked up about it and took the elegant weapon reverently. It looked like silver or polished tin, only brighter, and it was chased with Alcan writing along the face of the bow. It was gently recurved, like a horse archer's bow, and the string appeared to be braided green-gold Alcan hair. He inspected every inch of the beautiful weapon, expressed amazement about how light and strong it was, gave the string a few practice pulls, and then asked, with tears in his eyes, if he could try it out. A few moments later, we had vacated the circle. Sarakim had unstrung his old bow and stowed it on his back, and had knocked and drawn the new Alka bow. When he was ready, he signalled by firing it out over the bailey toward the pond. At its apogee, the enchanted arrow spell activated, and it burst into a brilliant blue and silver firework before falling just short of the wall, easily 500 yards away. That was a mighty gift. Sarakim had disappeared from the circle before the arrow reached its zenith.
I have him,
Lady Varen said, as she stared intently at nothing in particular.
He's Vavain,
she said decisively. Then she relaxed.
He should be where I sent him.
The Alka had given us several specific locations they felt most confident about sending us, based on pre-existing transport points left over from Alcan settlements long fallen into ruin. Sarakim was assigned to the first troop we were sending through, under the command of Baron Arathaniel. Most of the cavalry, over 700 horses, would be with them, as this transport point was the furthest away from the castle, and the cavalry would have the easiest time crossing that distance.
Is he there?
Taran asked urgently. I closed my eyes and waited, and waited, and waited. There were so many things that could go wrong, I knew, and while I anxiously waited, my sadistic mind forced me to consider every one of them, from mislocation to annihilation. As thoroughly as the Alka had explained the spell to us, we still knew little beyond theory, and the theory was replete with horrific possibilities. Finally, the first ghost of a contact came to my mind.
Mage Lord, I have arrived. I am safe and well.
Haste through,
I said, trying to keep the contact strong. I could hear cheers around me. What's the ground look like? I asked him. I hope it's as flat as they promised, because it's about to be occupied by horses.
As flat as my first wife's head, Sarakim assured me. Flat and empty. When I first appeared, there was a small patrol nearby, but this magnificent bow put an end to all of them before they could raise the alarm. My scrying shows no others in the area. You are safe to send them through.
He says it's safe, I announced. The cavalry was already filing into the circle, the Baron resplendent in his businesslike war armor. I had cautioned him and all of his men about the lack of a need for heraldry a knight usually brings to battle, as there would be no confusing friend from foe in this war. But he had insisted on bringing his personal banner, borne by his youngest son.
Mage Lord, the old nobleman called to me as he crossed the circle on his beautiful horse. I take it all is well with your sorcerers.
My man is present in Gilmore now, I agreed. It is brave of you to consent to this, Excellency. Beware the lure of chivalry here. You will receive no quarter from the Gavani. Slay all you see, for they shall extend to you the same courtesy. The site is clear for you and your men to arrive, and the moment you do, and you can order yourselves properly, ride to your position for all that you're worth.
It shall be done, my friend,
he agreed with a bellicose smile.
To be honest, I was a bit put out that you did not let us mount a proper charge against the Westphalians. Rarely have I gone to war, yet struck no blow in anger, particularly against the Warbird. This feels as if it will almost make up for it, though, he said with relish.
I'll never understand the chivalry until the day I die. I tried not to look like I thought he was an idiot.
The gods go with you, my friend, I agreed, and clasped his hand before he took position at the edge of the circle, where he began bellowing orders.
It took almost an hour to get that first third deployed properly within the transport space. To facilitate the spell, We had each one pick up a rock of snowstone and keep it on their person. Most of the men were unsure and unaware of exactly how they would get to the battlefield, save that it was by magical means. But without any other explanation, they figured that they were just waiting around again, as they had done most of the day and the days before that. Eventually the magic flying boats, or the mystical giant ducklings, or the horseless chariots of Perwin, or any of the other means legend and lore allowed magic to command, would show up to bear them away. My apprentice Tyndall rode with the more equestrian-oriented war magi among us. That included Jendaran, I noted, who seemed quite happy with his second-place prize as he rode a magnificent destrier into place. Tyndall would act as my liaison to Arathaniel via the mind-to-mind link. It had been instrumental in battle before, and I hoped it would be again. Coordinating our forces properly was the only way we could fight our way out of this. "Ready!" came the call from all five stones, behind which an Alka stood, some bearing sticks or bows, some not. I nodded to Lady Varen, and then warned Sarakim to clear the area. I drew power from my witch sphere in lavish quantity, as she directed. The High Magi did likewise with their stones, and the Alka added power of their own. With the assistance of every other High Mage there, we threw power into the Coven Stone in Lady Varen's hands. It pulsed increasingly bright as it drank in the power, collecting it into a massive reservoir. Lady Varen accepted the power carefully, and seemed to tremble a bit as she wove the spell. Then she came to some resolution and whispered a word. There was no flash, no bang, no mystical light. Almost 2,000 men and horses were just gone. They left behind only the horseshit and vomit that hadn't journeyed with them. Lady Varen looked strained. "That was difficult," she agreed, her humanish face pale. "It has been 2 ages since such a feat was attempted without proper arcane transport architecture in place. Next time I'll try to rent a molar part to help," I quipped. "If it is of the right variety, that would be helpful," she agreed with a straight face. Both of us knew that the aberrations of space and time were naturally occurring and could not be moved. Short of finding a way to create one here, it was a joke, or wishful thinking, or both. And I wasn't particularly eager to find out what a molopar would do around snowstone. The next troop marched into the space, as they were almost entirely infantry recruited from the Riverlands. Mercenaries and levies, with hundreds of archers, each bearing as many quivers as they could carry, marched between the stones. They were preceded by their small cavalry contingent, which included Sir Gimbal and his gentleman on horse, led and carefully watched by his former vassal, Sir Fetterlan of Hosley. I had met briefly with the man myself, an uncomfortable and humiliating event for both of us. There had been several long and intense discussions about his role in the battle. As he had been contributed by his brother to the king's summons, he was under royal command henceforth. Anything less than faithful service would be considered insubordinate and treasonous. Gimbal and his kin grumbled about it, but privately I had heard that he preferred honourable death in battle to skulking at his brother's heels, a constant reminder of his own failures. If revenge for his lost lands was on his mind, he did little to express it. He appeared to take me at face value when I told him I bore him no grudge that would affect my role as his military commander. He in turn stiffly swore that he would render service to the kingdom as faithfully as any honourable knight of the realm, and I had to take that at face value too. He was a loyal knight. He knew his duty to his overlord, he assured me. Any future conflict between us, or anyone else, would be put aside for the duration of his honourable service. He swore to it in front of Lord Brother Hamaris and a few dozen witnesses. That was about as much assurance as I would get about the ex-West Flareans, and I wondered if the future of this battle might weigh on the strength of the man's honour as he rode into place. The magic circle seemed roomier this time, with only 130 horses on the periphery, surrounding 1,500 assorted infantry troops and 400 archers. They wouldn't be fast, but they were strong. With them went Sir Rondal, my bookish apprentice, with the 20 other sparks who were to act as the troop's magical corps. The men crowded toward the center as they were directed, and when the last of them had stopped vomiting nervously, the Alka reactivated the spell. This time the men, under the leadership of Sir Taran the Sage, as the brilliant young war mage was being called behind his back, would appear only 3 miles from the castle to the southwest, the site of some ancient Alcan outpost. With the few cavalry troopers included, screening them and scouting ahead, the second troop would do a quick march to pre-agreed upon position, to wait for the other two troops to appear. That was the plan, at least. Again, all the High Magi summoned power, great heaping amounts of power, myself more than anyone, and directed to the Covenstone. Lady Varen again strained unsteadily to tame the flood of energy, to shape it and mould it and make it dance to her will. And then the circle was empty again.
"I may be able to manage a third," she said, "if I am refreshed."
I wasn't certain what that meant, but I nodded solemnly and turned my attention to ordering my troops into the circle. My troops. I was commanding them. More, they were my troops, mostly Bovali volunteers. While the cavalry had been anxious and the infantry had been unaware, the Bovali I was leading were enthusiastic about their role in the battle. 2 years ago, most had been smallholders, cheesemakers, cowhands, goatherders, shopkeepers and artisans far away in the Mindens. Now they were war-hardened and exiled, come at last to a homeland they could defend. This was their opportunity to strike back at the hated foe who had sent them into exile, who had killed their families and ravaged their homes. The men who marched proudly into the circle looked far more like the Wilderland warriors who'd fought by my side last year than the more civilized Riverland soldiers next to them, despite their access to superior armor and weaponry. All bore the snowflake badge of my house. Amongst the Wilderland men were a strong smattering of native Sevendori. Men had volunteered from Brestol, from Gurisham, from Sevendor Village, and even a few from disgraced Genli. Not everyone there had favored Raylan the Steady's approach or policies, and some were deeply offended by his treason. Seeing a few stalwart Genli men in Sevendor's ranks did my heart good. Pentandra would stay with me to advise me, and even Planus had donned armor and taken up a sword, although he swore he knew little enough about its use. Other civilian magi had joined us too, which gave my troop the largest magical core. Leading my small cavalry force was Sire Ronsel, who grumbled good-naturedly about the duty, and among his men was Sir Festeran. The young knight had taken to his small but burgeoning talent eagerly, and while he was far from a knight mage, he was at least capable of a few dozen simple cantrips. I was hoping I could keep an eye on him. But perhaps the most important Sevendori to ride with us was less than 5 feet tall and 13 years old. Dara of Westwood rode alongside her father on a small but sure-footed mare I'd had Tyndall select from the stables. She was wearing light archer armor that was too big for her, and a leather helmet. Her bird clung to a perch she'd built onto her saddle, and in a bag around her back she bore the box that contained the thoughtful knife. She had practiced with it constantly until she could sail circles around the castle. She thought it was great fun to chase and tease her own bird with it. I'm not sure I would have chanced it, but she had the recklessness of youth, and she heals quickly. Her father, two of her brothers, and two of her uncles were accompanying her, along with a dozen other Westwood men. I'd ordered them to personally protect young Dara, Pentandra, and the other soft magi when we were in combat. The leather-clad woodsmen grinned wolfishly, almost as enthusiastic about battle as the Bovali. Most of them had never ventured beyond Sevendor Village their entire lives. Then there were those who had ventured thousands of leagues. Lady Ithalia had arrived with her own bow and quiver and satchel full of magic, her weapons and bark-like armor refashioned to fit her larger, humanish form.
"Why," I began. "You came to my rescue once," she offered, "and I felt it was important that the Alca Alon be represented in this battle. However, slightly."
"It was against my advice," the leader of the Alca Alon delegation said quietly, but she was insistent. "Are you ready, Mage Lord?" asked Lady Varen patiently. She wasn't looking too well, but we were ready. The rest of the troop was more or less in place, and any stragglers who didn't want to be left behind had to hurry. I took just a moment to look out over the castle wall
and down the beautiful valley I had rescued from penury and oblivion. With magic's aid, I'd helped her heal, improved her bounty, and brought prosperity to her folk. With magic's aid, I'd defended her and expanded her borders. From the gleaming white walls of Sevendor Castle, through the brown fields and the green groves, from the sun-drenched south ridge to the perpetually shady north road, I had learned to love this little vale, as if I'd been born here. As a mage lord, I desired no other lands, no finer palaces, no more civilized people. I had taken a wasted domain, and with magic's aid, I had turned it into the kind of place where I felt like living, like ruling. Even if I died in the next few moments, I realized that I had left a great legacy to Menalion and his siblings, perhaps even to their descendants, if they had time to have any. That was really up to me, I realized, and how I fought against the Gavanni. If I failed, then the magic born in Sevendor would fade before it could take root. If I failed, then Menalion might not see his second winter or his third. I'm ready, I told Lady Varen, and waited for the universe to move around me.